Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz. And not joined today by Lahav Harkov, who is away on vacation. Instead, in her place is the great Tamar Be'eri.
Uriel Berry now.
Uriel Berry. I'm really, really sorry. Please forgive me. And Tamar is the managing editor of jpost.com. So any of our listeners who are coming to us through our website, who want to say something about the website, reach out to Tamar. And she'd be happy to hear your complaints, but probably more likely your compliments, right, Tamar?
Overjoyed, in fact.
Overjoyed. There's a lot going on, right? But yesterday, you and I went on a fun little field trip.
Yeah, kind of little escape from the intense realities of covering Israeli news, I think.
And we got to take a helicopter ride and to go see the Leviathan gas rig, which is located about 10 kilometers off the coast of Israel, opposite, I guess, Haifa, right? Is that
opposite Haifa? Yeah,
opposite Haifa. It was a cool little helicopter ride.
Yeah,
it's incredible. I mean, like, you know, I know a lot of people are going to go after us for Chevron.
Yeah, okay.
Setting aside the climate issue. Put aside climate issue for a moment.
If we set that aside for just one moment, on a technological level, it's just incredible being there.
And it's, I mean, how many pipes and valves and levers.
We had to duck and swerve several times to navigate around.
And we had to put on fire-resistant overalls.
Which were altogether very entertaining.
I think. And hard hats and metal-tipped boots. Yes. Yeah,
Yaakov made a point to test that the shoes are...
Test those. But just impressive. And I think that, you know, the reason that I wanted to go there was because, and soon to come a story on this in the next couple weeks, but... Israel is at an interesting juncture, I think, in a diplomatic slash economic opportunity to begin to use and leverage its gas, which it has found in throughout the Mediterranean, to create new relations. And with countries, we have the Turkish foreign minister as we're speaking.
Right.
He's here in Israel, going to visit the Temple Mount, meeting with Israeli foreign minister Yair Lapid, first visit of a Turkish foreign minister in 15 years to Israel. But also the fact that with Russia, Ukraine, Israel could up its energy game. And it was interesting to see firsthand what that would entail and how that would be possible. And that's what we saw. So there's more to come on that. But Tamar, since we do have you on the show.
Yeah.
What's going on the Jerusalem Post website? What's new? What are we doing?
Well, I mean, we have several different portals for everyone to explore according to their own interests. Our business and innovation website is something that's really launched off recently. We have a bunch of very exciting exclusive content on that front. So for any of you tech savvy folks, there's a lot to read on that front. The Startup Nation is big and better than ever, I think.
Unicorns rolling out all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Companies valued at a billion and up. I met a guy the other day who I knew... was friendly with about 10 years ago. Hadn't seen him in a long time. He has set up a company, something in cryptocurrency. Don't ask me to explain because I can't. And he told me, yeah, okay, we just did another round. And we're actually, our valuation now is going up to about $8 billion. And I'm like, what?
These proportions are just astronomical.
It's insane. It's insane. And he looks like a total schlump. I mean, if you see this guy.
I mean, listen, I think this is something...
A very wealthy schlump, might I say.
I think that's something to be said about Israel's high-tech industry. Startup fellas, if you're listening, let's go shopping for you. Let's get you some new outfits, some better-fitting clothing.
The gray t-shirt, jeans doesn't work.
The gray polo and the blue jeans with the Blundstones. Or if it's summer, the Birkenstocks.
Wait, hold on. I'm wearing a gray polo and I'm wearing blue jeans. No Blundstones, though. No Blundstones.
This isn't actually a podcast recording. This is an intervention.
Okay, maybe I got to up the fashion game. But I'm a journalist. Journalists, we don't have to dress well, right? We have to write well. Ah, okay.
Oh,
there you go. No, I mean, I guess we should know how to appear. But wait, enough about my attire for a moment.
Yes.
What is... So we have the business innovation portal.
Yes.
We have health and wellness.
Health and wellness has been really, really big, especially now, actually, if we're discussing it already, the monkeypox situation, which feels big and more dire than ever. Although if we look at it, there's one confirmed case in Israel.
Right.
The spread of it is extremely difficult to
happen. Right.
And in reality, a vaccine for it already exists. Now, I'm particularly entertained if we're
looking. It's a smallpox vaccine that's connected somehow.
Exactly. They say now the World Health Organization has recently released a statement saying that they believe that most of the infections in the U.S., not in the U.S., sorry, UK. In the U.K., were due to two raves in the country. So those wishing to stay healthy, stay away from the parties, apparently.
By the way, in the beginning of COVID, correct me if I'm wrong, it's been a while, but they also said it started to spread because it was ski season, and it started Austrian skiers had gone to the French Alps or Italy or something.
There were
something
so many theories about it. Yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. But fun stuff leads to risk, right?
Naturally.
So
so we've got full health and wellness coverage.
We did really good. Our Shira Silkoff, who's been covering health for us over the last few months. So Shira did a great piece about all the other illnesses and diseases that we have to worry
about. What's our next pandemic?
What's the next thing? Because we might as well scare ourselves. Why not? Right. It's become popular to do that in the last couple of years. People enjoy knowing what's going to kill them.
I also think that it's something that just as like a Jewish nation, it really...
The anxiety nation.
The anxiety nation. Exactly. I think it's something that definitely is a unique quality of this country.
Maybe tell our listeners, because I think it interests people. I know when they always like to ask me, what do people like to read online? I mean, you're following the metrics, you're looking at analytics.
I am.
What do people like to read?
So I'll tell you, first of all, people love dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
People love the dinosaurs. Just recently, we had a story.
That's not what I think people thought they were going to hear.
Oh, no.
They thought Palestinian conflict, Naftali Bennett coalition,
no, people
Iran threat, and you say dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs and asteroids, and dinosaurs who have been hit by asteroids.
They usually come together.
They usually do come hand in hand. Generally speaking, our science content is something that we find that a lot of readers and listeners are interested in. On top of that, there's a lot of archaeological content in Israel. I feel like that kind of makes sense, right? Because as a nation where
this country is loaded in history.
Exactly.
And I mean, I'm looking at a story right now that a 2,100-year-old agricultural farmstead was uncovered in a dig in northern Israel. And this is like from the Hellenistic Hasmonean period.
Correct. And there are amazing photos to go along with it, by the way.
And they found candles. This doesn't really look like a candle. Does that? No.
That's actually...
I don't know. Not a candle.
It's kind of like a candle holder thing from ancient times. They would fill that.
A 2,000-year-old candle.
Exactly. Right.
On a more serious topic for a moment, coalition is again in trouble. If last week was the member of Knesset Zoabi from Meretz who pulled out, came back.
False alarm situation.
She seems to be okay. This week was the announcement that Naftali Bennett's chief of staff, Tal Gansvi, who has been with him for 10 years, disclaimer, good friend of mine, has decided to step down. And we can just say that, yes, I think it's a blow potentially to Bennett and to his coalition because Gansvi was the holder of the right-wing portfolio and kind of that flank within the coalition, number one. Number two is he had been with Naftali Bennett for 10 years.
Right.
And his walking away kind of does further destabilize potentially the internal office. He comes on the heels of Naftali Bennett's diplomatic advisor, Shimri Meir, who stepped down 2 weeks ago. So clearly there's some shaking going on within his inner office and the coalition just today. Right, we're recording this on Wednesday. Michael Biton, a member of Knesset from Blue and White, has said, I'm not going to vote with the coalition anymore. Mm. We got the Jerusalem Day Parade coming Sunday. We saw what happened last year, that was the day that Guardian of Walls operation, last conflict with Gaza began. Palestinians are again threatening. I spoke with Khaled Abu Tuama, our Palestinian affairs reporter. He's writing a story about that. There's just a lot that can happen that can shake things up.
Right. Everything kind of feels like it's a balancing act that's on the brink of collapse.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that we've been seeing specifically for the past few weeks with this specific coalition. But it feels like Bennett's slowly losing his foundation. The ground is falling from below.
It's like a sinking ship. And the question is that a lot of people, I guess, have to wonder is... In people who are involved, who are on the ship, is at what point do you jump, right?
Right.
I think that's where a lot of people are right now, and everyone's making their calculations, right? Defense Minister Benny Gantz says the other day, we're going to evacuate the illegal outpost of Chomesh. Members of the Amina Party Naftali Bennett's party said, if you do that, we're going to pull out of the coalition. Everywhere you look, there's a minefield. And this government is just going to be stuck maneuvering through that minefield
constantly
every step
with
of the
every
way.
Decision that they're going to face. It's going to reach this same impasse because of the nature of it being this mixed coalition, which on the one hand, of course, reflects Israeli society. But on the other hand, we're not moving anywhere.
Which is what my big criticism would be, is that we're kind of stuck, right?
And right.
Big decisions have to be made. There was a nice diplomatic feather in Naftali Bennett's cap this week with Joe Biden, the president's basic decision that he will not be delisting the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the bad Iranian military, from the FTO, the Foreign Terrorist Organization list of the U.S. State Department. That was something that Bennett worked hard on, Yair Lapid worked hard on. And so that's a nice diplomatic feather in his cap, but that's not what's going to keep the coalition together.
Right. That's just one tiny feather.
That's a nice thing to have, but that's not going to be enough to keep things calm, quiet, and keep your 60 members and quickly dwindling number of members of your coalition happy. But the other, and you know, that kind of ties into the IDF scholarship bill, right?
Right.
What was that?
Well, I mean,
what's the bill? Tell us what the bill is.
So to my understanding, the bill was basically to create a better foundation for a scholarship for post IDF.
Right. So if you're in the army,
combat
and you
soldiers.
Serve, you, and this is what all the politicians were saying. You served us. Now it's our opportunity to serve you.
Yeah. To give back
and to give you free higher education. Mm-hmm. Right. I think we could say magia lehem, right? They deserve it, right? As they would say in Hebrew.
Yes.
Soldiers, you served in the army. I served in the army. We should have had free education. We didn't. We had to pay our way.
Right. And we saw a bit of a more expansive support for this bill, which is nice to see kind of people from the right and the center and even a bit from the left kind of coming together over this one decision.
But it became a political battle.
Of course it did. Naturally, it was. It became less of an issue of helping those who have served the country and more of an issue of down with the coalition.
Right. Especially. So Likud, Benjamin Netanyahu refused, the former prime minister refused to back the bill. There was a recording that came out of Miri Regev, who, by the way, is a former brigadier general. She was the IDF spokesperson. And she said, we will not support this. We don't care about the soldiers. We don't care about rape. We don't care about other things. I mean, it was like a crazy recording.
Oh my God.
But it just it goes to show how everything in this in politics is legitimate, right? You can fight about anything. Nothing matters. And that's sad.
It is kind of sad. Everybody's kind of looking for a way to leverage themselves, whether or not it actually serves their platform. And I think specifically Likud supporters can look at the way that the party's handling bills that if they were in the coalition, they would happily support.
Oh, of course, but it's not about – that's the misconception.
Okay.
People, they don't care about the people, right? I'm sorry. It's a secret. Don't tell anyone. Politicians, they're not really here to help the people. They're here to help themselves, right? And I think that that's what we sadly keep on discovering.
The hard way.
Okay, you know, I probably shouldn't say all politicians. I shouldn't generalize. There's some exceptions. And I think they probably do all come in with good intentions. And that's for sure. And they want to make the world a better place, no doubt.
And then it's downhill from there.
Yeah.
Got it. I think something interesting on Army Radio on Tuesday, one of the heads of the organization that was vying for this bill to be passed, a law student who is also post-combat, said that despite the voting distribution on it, he saw both coalition and opposition widespread support for the bill behind closed doors. It's just that's not what was expressed in the vote itself.
Although in the end, it has to be said, vote passed, right?
It did.
The coalition upped, it was supposed to be 60-something percent that they were going to pay for the scholarship. It went up to 75%. Netanyahu had been asking for 100%. And then in the end, what happened was Likud just didn't vote, right? So they didn't vote against it. They walked out. They weren't there. And the coalition had a majority to pass the vote.
That's right.
So that's at least good. Soldiers, my daughter, going into the army in September.
Mazel tov.
So she'll get a free education?
Well, is she going into combat?
It's combat. I should convince her now to switch units. Save a few bucks.
My little sister, Noah, she's going to get it once she's
out. She's going to get it. Okay.
She's going to need it. She wants to be a
doctor. I'm going to have to make a phone call after this to my daughter. It's time to go into a combat unit. I mean, there's that going on. We have, and then there's Abu Akleh, right? Shirin Abu Akleh. That story is not behind us. We're going to talk later in the show with Peter Lerner, yes. Lieutenant Colonel, retired Peter Lerner, who was the former IDF spokesperson for the international media, but also was the IDF spokesperson for the Central Command, which mm-hmm. is the regional command in the IDF that was responsible for the West Bank. So he knows these areas very well in these types of operations.
That's right.
And we'll talk about kind of the fallout, but there was that big CNN report that came out.
Right.
That was not.
For us, it came out last night.
Not positive for Israel.
Didn't look too good for us. CNN reported that without a doubt, from conclusive evidence they have seen, Israel fired the shot that killed Abu Akleh.
Deliberately and intentionally. Shoddy journalism, can I just say? I read the piece a couple of times. I don't like criticizing media because I feel like if I do it, then they're going to do it to me. So, you know, better stay away. But their main piece of evidence was this UK security expert who examined imagery of the tree next to where Shireen Abu Akleh was standing and said, based on the way the shots hit the tree, it was a deliberate thing. I mean, so you're looking at images of a tree and that's how you're making some of your decisions. And right. everyone else there are Palestinians who they're not obviously objective. So I think that CNN might have jumped a bit too far, but the bigger story to me, at least, is that, and we've said over and over again, her death is a tragedy.
Yes.
I think it wasn't handled necessarily well by Israel. Definitely what happened at the funeral was horrific, the way the police acted.
Right. But, and we'll hear more on that from Peter.
But the bigger story is that this is something that's still accompanying Israel. And they're going to have to, this is an issue that's not going
away. We're going to have to face several hurdles, Israel as a state, in that regard, because this is definitely not the last time we're going to hear an argumentation like this. And I'm sure that we'll hear from the other side as well, saying the map shows that without a doubt, it was the other side doing it. You know, it's going to continue.
It's part of the information war that is just being fought all the time. So we'll talk about that with Peter. He's coming up in the meantime tomorrow. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for filling in for Lahav today.
With pleasure.
And here's Peter Lerner.
This is the last moment we see Shireen Abu Akleh walking with colleagues, seemingly at ease. Seconds later, she's lying motionless on the ground.
I just watch her and there is no up and down. She didn't breathe. And this is make me crazy.
Peter, it's great to have you here.
Great to be here again.
You actually used to work in this building, if I'm not mistaken. On the first floor, back when you were the spokesperson, international media spokesperson for the IDF, right?
That's true, yeah.
And before that, I mentioned in the introduction, you were also the spokesperson for the Central Command.
That's right.
Right, so you kind of know not only the international media, but you also know the IDF and its operations in places like Jenin in the West Bank.
Yeah, I had a very extensive term, but also even before then with COGAT and civil administration. So I spent a lot of my military career in this neighborhood.
Right. And you and I had some times over the years that we ran up and down some hills in the Judean desert
things. The paratroopers.
Yeah. We had some fun. So Shireen Abu Akleh, you watched the CNN footage. You read the story, as I'm sure many people did. But you walked away and people can read your Twitter thread and see what your thoughts were, but you did not feel that this was a good piece of journalism.
My first feeling was disappointment from CNN. I looked at it and I thought, huh? Then I watched it again and then I read through it again. I thought, there's something missing in this story and it's the smoking gun. They didn't get it. So in this supposedly expose of what actually happened, they didn't get the story. They just regurgitated what was already said.
The claims that were already
made. Yeah, the claims based on Palestinian sources and eyewitnesses, based on footage, which there was a whole bunch of footage from all over the place within Jenin on that terrible, tragic day. And then they brought in this supposed neutral analyst, military,
the British analyst, guy who's looking at photos of a tree.
Yeah, and from that he's concluded that it was intentional, and based on photos of a tree. So either he's good at talking to trees or he's good at reading minds.
Right.
So I was let down. I think I follow international media and I've always been attached to CNN and interviewed millions of times with them for pieces, good and bad, and challenging.
Back in your days when you were on floor number one in this building and CNN's on floor number three, exactly. Then, you know, it wasn't just, that far.
But that was the type of experience that I had with working with CNN, even when there was a difficult story and, you know, the reality on the ground in the territories, with the conflict, in the occupation, and with the exchanges that the IDF finds itself with the Palestinian population, these incidents are going to happen. But they always gave me time of day. Their reports, investigative reports, would be balanced, and they would try and project what is actually happening, but also give you the opportunity to respond.
And here there was not one single Israeli talking head.
No spokesperson. Nobody spoke. Nobody was, I don't know if they were given the opportunity, but it was clear that they were rushing into telling this story. Okay. Right?
So let's zoom out though of CNN for a moment. CNN, it's a symptom of a larger problem, absolutely, I think. And Shirin Abu Akleh, what it shows me to an extent is that this story is just not going away. Right.
For sure.
And I agree with you 100%. Major tragedy. Journalists should not be killed. You had met her. You knew her. I did not.
She interviewed me outside this building.
Right. Okay. So a prominent journalist, of course, she should be protected. She shouldn't be killed in crossfire. But, when you look at the overall story of the management of Israel, of the situation, we then saw the fallout at the funeral, which was just disastrous in my view. What do you think of the larger management of this whole thing?
So I think on the outset, what actually stuck out to me was it was actually managed. So when I was looking, I was seeing the prime minister, I was seeing the foreign minister, and I was seeing the IDF all on the same page from messaging perspective. They were all mostly in sync with what are we saying now? And they were all basically on the ball together. I had similar experiences where Palestinians were killed in a confrontation with IDF, and it was just Peter speaking. It was just the IDF. So here you have the system which is actually working, which I think is, it's a breath of fresh air. It's still not enough to counter the terrible images. You can't really do that.
Right.
But that, of course, is the initial phase. And then you go to the scuffling around the funeral. I mean, it doesn't matter how professional a spokesperson you are or what type of...
You can't explain that away.
Yeah, there's no explaining. It just, you know, it looks, it feels, and it was...
a disaster. Horrible.
I don't want to be rude. I think that it could have been managed from a distance. I think the guidelines for the forces probably could have been clearer.
By the way, you saw that report on Channel 11 in Israel that there were comms teams that had told the police be careful and that the policemen had ignored them.
Yeah, I don't know if they, again, at the end of the day, there's an operational development. They have their operational responsibility, which always trumps the media perception.
Right.
And this is always going to be the reality, at least for the foreseeable future in Israel, where you have a reality, an operational reality on the ground, which might not look good on the cameras. And at the end of the day, the security forces need to deliver public order and public safety and security. But this was an ambush waiting to happen, this incident. And it should have been dealt with cotton gloves. It should have been really, you know, through that prism, understanding the problems and understanding the how it is going to be seen should have been much higher on the priority list. Add to the fact that the police don't have an international spokesperson at this time, so there's nobody really to mitigate the developments or even communicate in real time what actually happened. What were the instructions to the police? How are they trying to maintain public order? It went through filters of Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Prime Minister's office, or whoever was communicating on behalf of the police, or even the police in Hebrew, which doesn't necessarily translate.
Right. They're not necessarily also thinking about how things are going to look outside the borders of the state of Israel.
I would say they're necessarily not thinking.
They're necessarily not thinking. This is true. The police, I think, in general, look at every problem as if it's a nail and they are the hammer, and therefore they just use force to attack whatever problem they face. And that's what we saw when they went with bats after people who were carrying their casket, when you know that the whole world's going to be watching this funeral. Like, it wasn't,
Until the funeral, I was sure that the system had survived this incident, that the news cycle will move on.
No.
And that was it. But then the funeral happened, and it extended the news interest in this story for another 2 or 3 days.
But now even CNN is continuing, and now all the news organizations. I mean, we wrote a story based on what CNN did, as did every other Israeli media outlet and probably Jewish media outlet in the world. What would your recommendation be now to the government of how to manage the situation? Because it's not going away.
So it will go away because the news cycle and the events in this region, they are so fast and upbeat that they move from skip from one to another. It will move away. It will, you know, there'll be an Australian TV channel which will do another investigative report. But basically, the story is told.
Right.
Unless the only reason it should come back again is if the bullet is passed on to the Israelis.
And they test and they prove that it wasn't. And
they prove that it was or it wasn't. And then if it wasn't, then it won't get much coverage. If it was, then it'll get all of the coverage again.
Of course.
But that's how it'll work. These incidents, while they have a huge impact, there is a time constraint on them. They, you know, if tomorrow, 2 days, it'll be gone. It'll be in the history of social media and internet and so on. But the event itself, from a media perspective, or even a management or crisis management perspective, it will be over. It'll be on to the next. And you can be sure that there will be the next.
So can Israel, I had a feeling at the time, and you and I spoke about this, that what Israelis might be missing in the bigger picture is that this is an isolated tactical incident, whether she was killed by an Israeli bullet, she was killed by a Palestinian bullet, obviously a very tragic incident, should never have happened. Okay, some lessons will be learned if it was by Israel, not the Palestinians. But there's a bigger question here, which is that for the world, they might be focused on the tactical incident, but really what they're focused on is why is Israel going into a city like Jenin? They call it the occupation. They look at this as the invasion of a occupation military that is entering into a innocent Palestinian city. And there, what's the story that Israel's telling?
So that is the international frame of context, media coverage.
Right.
That's the context. That's the framing of the story. It's the David and Goliath, and Israel is the Goliath versus Palestinian David. And of course, you know, without any political horizon of any sort, you know, because 2 years ago they were talking about annexation, which is ridiculous, but at least there was some sort of government idea of where they wanted to take the territories or how a government foresees that. But that without a broader context, a broader political context within Israel, they're always going to tell the story from that angle of occupation, of apartheid that they like, that has become the catchphrase of the last 2 years with organizations, Israelis and human rights organizations, using that phrase to try and tag the situation here as such. And until there is an alternative debate around this issue, that is where it's going to be. The government, without talking about the issue, can't frame it any other way.
But the government doesn't want to talk about the issue. I mean, this government definitely doesn't want to talk about the issue, and I don't know that any government ever wants to talk about the issue. So the question that I also wonder, you know, I was speaking to a group of very smart students from one of the Ivy League schools in the United States visiting Israel. And, you know, they're getting their media, Western media sources, probably also social media, Instagram, TikTok, and things like that, right? And, you know, you got to be there, right? Mm-hmm. You got to be on those platforms. But every time that you get asked a question, you feel like you have to give context, right? You know, why was the IDF in Jenin that day in May 11th when Shirin Abu Akleh was killed? Because a couple days earlier was the terrorist attack in Elad where three fathers were murdered by these two axe-wielding Palestinian terrorists. They came from the area of Jenin, and they went – and the IDF then naturally goes a few days later into Jenin to try to round up the next bad guy who might be coming on attack. But that's a lot to explain. People don't have the patience, the time, the energy. They can't read.
And I would say they're not even really interested.
Right.
They are interested in the human interest component of the story. People are interested in seeing why are people being hurt, but they don't want to understand it, the in-depth story. It you know, people are tired from this story, so you can't really go into that type of explanation.
I lose their attention when I start to explain what happened and why they were there, and you know, suddenly you know, I'm back in 1948.
Some of Israel's public diplomacy has always been, no, but we have to talk about the context.
Right.
And I think talking about the context is important, but it can't be the essence of the conversation. The essence of the conversation, in my opinion, is where do we want to go? We want to live in peace with our neighbors. How do we achieve that? We need strong leadership. We need the ability to have somebody, a partner, to make peace with. I think we need to be talking not about the past, but about the future.
So you're saying, if I get you right, that if there was a political process that was happening at this time, and there was this optimism on the horizon, then things would be a little different?
I think even the notion of some sort of dialogue and communication and negotiations to a certain extent, just the notion gives Israel an upper hand. Because we, you know.
What does that mean, the notion?
I think we had a period when Tzipi Livni was negotiating about nothing.
Right.
But they were talking. You know, we've had so many years where there's been this disconnect with the Netanyahu governments consecutively saying we have no partner and therefore we won't waste our time.
Right.
And the world looks at you and say, huh, that's not how you manage business. You manage business by negotiating. If you want to buy something or sell something, you have to sit down with whoever you want to buy or sell. So if Israel doesn't want to buy or sell, then they're to blame, especially as the stronger party. So the notion of, you know, I accept that I have a partner in the region that I have to sort out my business with. And it might not be this partner now, and it might not be the specific individual Abu Mazen that I can actually create a deal with or make the deal of the century. Yeah. There was talk about it even back then. Mm-hmm. But it needs to be in the background and the atmosphere of, we want to sort this out. People are tired. That's why if they're tired and you're just saying, you know, you're this in this bottled down position of not, I don't care. It's like a little kid with their hands over their ears going la, 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 la. Then the world looks at you like the infantile. Mm-hmm. And do you want to be that?
So Israel is being looked at right now like the infantile?
I actually think that the last year that has been relieved a bit because of the political change here. But I think
the world gives this new government a little credit.
I think the world gives this government a little credit. I think the world sees the spectrum of the political parties in this government and realizes there's possible for change, or there is a possibility for change here. I don't believe that it's actually possible today. I don't think there's the ability on our leadership. I don't think there's ability on the Palestinian leadership to sort it out. But people are giving us a bit more room. I mean, even President Biden seems to be, you know, not pushing Israel in any strong direction.
I agree with the assessment that it seems like everyone kind of understands that nothing's going to happen. Not with this government, in Jerusalem, not with Abu Mazen and Ramallah, and therefore there's no real reason to push. They push a little, you know, settlements, they say we're not happy
wise.
With it.
I think they want us to be wise and don't be, you know, put your finger in my eye. I think Biden had the experience of having fingers in his eyes
when he came to Israel back in 2010, and we announced the same day that he was here that we're building in parts of East Jerusalem. Don't make the same mistake twice.
Yeah.
And they should, hopefully, you know, they'll get that right when he comes, if he comes at the end of June, if there's still a government standing.
Hopefully.
we shall see. So Peter, you know, a lot of Jews around the world, and some of them listen to this podcast, I hope, they're very frustrated. They sit at home, and I get this question, I'm sure you get this question all the time. What can we do? What can change? How can we help Israel? So I give, you know, what my standard answer is, it's read the Jerusalem Post. Now, yeah.
That's good advice.
Good advice. Because, I mean, it comes from obviously a very self-serving place.
I would never have thought.
I know.
I'm shocked.
Right. No, it comes from that, but it also, it's also be educated, just know information, know more about things, but you know, put that as, what would your answer be to people Because I'm sure you get this question a lot as well.
So I think you have to always seek out who are the people that are actually open to listen to what you have to say. I think this is such a charged issue. There are people that are so embedded in their own opinions on this subject that if you're perceived as pro-Israeli and they are not, there's no room for debate. So you need to be able to make the arguments or project your opinion and convey those in a way that can at least be heard, if not accepted. I think sometimes this is where we miss some of the arguments in Israel, that, you know, because we're right and people, it doesn't make an argument. That doesn't really, that doesn't really resonate. But I would say, it's try and engage the people that are actually open to listening and want to hear what you think about the situation. There's no point getting into this shouting game where it doesn't do anything. People, as I said, they're so embedded in their own strong opinions. They live in their echo chambers that amplify to themselves what they're thinking all the time anyway. And social media has amplified that so strongly that it's a waste of energy and it drains you.
No, I agree with that. I mean, another on this note, what I've discovered over time, I'll give you an example from this morning. So the Jerusalem Post internet desk writes up a rewrite of the CNN story, right? Which all media did in Israel, from Yediot Ahronot, Ynet, Haaretz, Times of Israel, everybody, Channel 12, you were on TV talking about it. Mm. And in the morning I start getting text messages from one of the top guys in one of the media watchdog organizations. Mm. Writing to me, sending me the link, you have the story, you have this, and I'm waiting for, okay, what does he want? Like, what is he out to tell me? And then he says, and you hear you have the statement of the IDF, and I said, I know I have the statement of the IDF, but again, what do you want? Like, what's the purpose of this conversation? Well, it's too low down in the article. The statement of the IDF should be higher up. And I think to myself sometimes, like, that's not the issue here. Right. You know, it's also not my job. Like, I am not the mouthpiece. The Jerusalem Post is not the mouthpiece for the Israeli government. We're media. Right. And I wonder in the conversation about how you talk to people and how you convince people is also, you don't always have to say Israel's right. It's possible to say Israel's wrong, makes mistakes. We can criticize Israel, but we can also, and then your argument becomes even stronger. No?
I mean, I think that is the fundamentals. People need to decide for themselves. You can't impose your opinion on them. And so if you feel as an editor that, you know, where the IDF response needs to fit in order for it to be accepted at all, or if you want to shove it down the throat right at the top, off of the top, then you're going to, it's a problematic decision. But I would actually say you need to give people the ability to agree with you based on what they understand from what you're saying. So you can't dictate. People, you know, people have this abundance of ability to choose the amount of information they receive.
Right.
And so they, you know, whether it's on their feed in Twitter or the newspapers or websites or television, what they see and they want to choose to accept what you're telling them. So you need to give them the ability, I would say, actually craft that message in a way where they will be able to accept it. And that's why when you say Israel may be wrong, absolutely, I think that is in conveying that type of understanding that in the Shirin Abu Akleh story, there's a distinct possibility that she was shot by an IDF soldier. And the question needs to be around, was it intentional? Was it a mistake? Misidentification? Was it a ricochet? And that remains to be determined. But those are the options. My personal opinion, I think actually she was shot by the IDF. I don't believe in any way or form that it was intentional.
No, of course not.
And that's why if you can convey, I think, you know, the initial knee-jerk response by the IDF was it could have been Palestinians. And And it took them a few hours to say it could have actually been us as well. And I think in the initial framing of that story of saying, you know, we're on the ground, there's this fog of war, we won't know until the forces are out of Jenin, they were still in Jenin, and the story was still being reported. When the forces come out, we'll do the debriefing and we'll be able to come to some sort of conclusion, initial conclusion.
Right.
And there's a distinct possibility she was killed by a soldier.
But as you know, the Hasbara industry, there is little of that criticism and defense. It's just
defense. No nuance.
There's little nuance, yeah.
But it is very much an echo chamber. When they're reaching out beyond the echo chamber to try and influence...
That's where it becomes difficult. Right.
And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes
I think part of it we have to recognize, yes, the country can do wrong. Yeah. It's a democracy like every other country.
It happens. I mean, I probably make 7 mistakes a day, you know. We're just, you know...
Well, I have no doubt that you do, and let's talk about one of those for a moment. You work right now. You've been out of the army for a few years.
And 5.
5 years. Wow. Okay. That's a long time. We're all getting old. and you work for the Histadrut, the labor federation union in Israel, workers union.
Yeah.
So you're a communist, socialist, Marxist, I don't know, something like that. But
you are visionary.
It's another way of looking at it. And you are their head of foreign relations.
That's right.
Director of foreign relations. Mm. So you're working with other communists around the world. This is fantastic.
All of the left wing. Right. They're not all left, but most of them.
You guys had elections the other night.
Yesterday.
And Arnon Bar David, the incumbent won, defeated a prior head of the Histadrut, Ofer Eini.
Yeah.
So tell us, what is, I mean, just, I think, I don't know how much our listeners even know what the Histadrut is, what they do, why they're important, how they serve the country. Give us the 2-minute spiel.
The Histadrut was a fundamental part of the establishment of the State of Israel. The Histadrut was actually established in 1920. And in the 28 years before the State of Israel came into fruition, it laid the foundations of everything. Mm-hmm. And when I say everything, Bank HaPoalim, the workers' bank, was owned by the federation.
I got an interview. Jerusalem Post, once upon a time, owned by the Histadrut.
I didn't know that.
Yeah?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Back in like the 60s, 70s.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you have the entire... components of the well-being, it's the general federation of labor. So the concept of generality means that we take care of the worker from morning to night, from birth till death. Mm-hmm. And basically, from education, from healthcare, the Kupat Cholim Klalit was a Histadrut body. So the formative years, and I would say up until probably the 50s and 60s, the Histadrut felt that it was the state, and there are still people today still thinks that Histadrut is the state. So I would say that was the formative component of creating workplaces, and I would say, and the life work balance in context of how we talk about the subjects today. But throughout the years, it's developed and it has become, but it always been an influential component in the economy of the State of Israel,
right?
And over the recent, probably last 20 years, it's more and more a professional trade union movement, empowering workers in the workplace, increasing or trying to improve health and safety in the workplace, incorporate issues of inclusion and diversity in the workplace.
Increasing minimum wage.
Increasing the minimum wage. And I would say being a party at the table of the decision makers for the economy.
How many Israelis are members in the Histadrut?
We have almost 800,000 members.
Wow.
Yes, it's like a quarter of the economy of workers in the economy.
Of the Israeli workforce.
Yeah, of the Israeli workforce. And it's a quarter, but it's a substantial quarter. It's a quarter that is the public service. It's a quarter that is... unique industries like insurance and telecommunications and also private businesses as well.
High tech at all? Are they there?
High tech, I would say, but in the low tech side of high tech. So it's the production lines of high tech, putting the chips together and those types of things. It's a trade union movement that is breeding a I would say it's trying to reinvent itself to address the challenges of the world of work as they develop today. You know, automation, digitalization, distance working, home working from home, all of these concepts which have been so, you know, in the last 2 years because of COVID, we've been talking about so much. These are the issues of the world of work and the future of the world of work. So these need a different type of trade union movement that can support workers. Unionized workers in Israel earn an average of 13% more than people who aren't unionized. So if there's any reason to join a union, that would be it.
Make more money.
You make more money, but it's not only money. You have support groups. You know, you have legal advice. You have once you're a member. So it's rising the level of life, but also supporting beyond the workplace. I didn't think I was going to work. I mean, I retired from the military. I was happy to be full-time dad. That's basically all I wanted to do. And when they started approaching me, I thought, this is my second calling. The world of work is probably the biggest challenge of humanity for the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to work? How are we going to make an income? Do we need a basic income for everybody so that nobody needs to be poor today? There is so much money in big tech, but
right.
There are still places of poverty and pockets of exclusion and disparities in wages between gender. So there is so much that needs to be done in order to level the playing ground for everybody so that more people can enjoy more of the wealth.
And your third calling is the beard? Because you guys can't see this, but Peter has one of the more impressive beards you will ever see.
So, 25 years in the military, shaving every morning to the skin, and I came out of the army, and I was still shaving.
Go wild. You said, I got to go wild. This is
still
the rebellion.
I was still shaving.
It was either this or like
COVID
a sports
came
car?
On, and I never, wasn't meeting anybody. It was always on either on Zoom or on the phone or emails. And it just grew because you didn't shave.
Oh, has it grown? There might be something alive in there.
No? Actually, it's becoming a bit of a trademark. So I don't know my wife and I, we have words about it from time to time, but she loves me enough to keep it.
Okay, everyone, imagine Herzl. It's there, but it's red, right? So it's a little different. And I guess it's probably cheaper than a sports car for like a midlife crisis. Although all the oils and brushes.
My midlife crisis is actually motorcycle. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So that's still to come.
It's on its way.
Hopefully. Okay. Yeah, whoa. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Whoa. That's big news here.
It's coming into Jerusalem when the traffic here, you can't do that. You need a motorcycle.
You need a motorcycle. Peter Lerner, great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast. And to our listeners, you can find us always every week on all the different podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple, Google Play, you name it. We're there, and we hope to see you again. Take care.